It's nice to be back. I've been away for a month teaching a month-long retreat at Spirit Rock, and it was really a wonderful thing to have done. It was one of the probably the most satisfying retreats I've done. I taught many retreats, partly because of the great extent because of how profound it was for the participants. There was a wide range of ways in which the retreat had impacted the people who were there, but very deep practice on many different fronts. And partly it was because I've taught a month-long retreat in February before, and Spirit Rock every year does two retreats back-to-back, one in February and one in March, and some people will stay for both months. And this year we have 23 people who stayed over from February to March. So there's a lot of continuity, and that added to some of the stillness or the depth of the retreat. So one of the marvelous things that happens to some human beings when they engage kind of fully, completely in some activity is by the time they finish it, they feel kind of emptied. You ever had that experience? Well, that's what I feel. And I just couldn't get myself to think of a topic to give a talk about today. I felt like I just emptied myself. I didn't have anything more to give in terms of, you know, giving a talk. So I feel, you know, a little bit regretful since you've come here and you're also sitting here quite eager and ready for something to happen. But perhaps you could all leave. Perhaps instead, this would be a great time for us to do a session of questions and answers. I'd like to do that periodically, and we haven't done it for quite a while, and you've had a series of guest speakers, and maybe something has come up for. It also gives me a chance to kind of get a sense of what's going on for you guys in terms of your practice that I wouldn't have a sense from if I just talked, you know, if I just had a monologue. Would anybody like to ask? You know, one thing I did some years ago, we did this some years ago, many years ago, I remember, and I asked for a question, and then I asked for another question, and then I asked for another question. I didn't answer any of the questions. And then we spent the whole evening people just asking questions. And it was really profound. I think anybody remember that? Anybody there that day? Dick, you were there, remember? Wasn't it profound? It was surprisingly profound. And there is something really significant in the human being's ability to ask questions. In Zen, they put a big premium on our ability to ask questions. That the Dharma unfolds much more strongly and more powerfully as we ask questions as we go along. Rather than thinking the Dharma is something, or practice, spiritual practice, something that's given to you, and then you kind of know the truth or know what to do, X, Y, and Z. And it's rather something you discover on your own, partly through your questioning, your ability to inquire into what's going on, what's happening. In Zen, they have this idea that every situation you find yourself in has a request of you. And then, so your task then is to figure out what that request is. So it's kind of like you go with this question. What is the request of this situation? What's the situation calling forth, asking for? Some Zen people will like to, will kind of massage any situation with different questions. I mean, the question of what it's called for here. Or what is it to be free in this situation? What is it, where is the compassion in this situation? What is real in this situation here? So to ask questions and the ability to learn how to ask questions. When I studied with one of my first Zen teachers, he had made that very explicit that he didn't want to have a lot of interviews with us until we had reflected a lot on our concerns until we could kind of distill in our concerns what he called the kernel of the issue. And then we'd bring that kernel of issue, a question, to him and say, this is what the real issue is. And often, people ask questions and it's not really the kernel. One of the tricks of the trade of people who receive questions, like Dharma teachers who receive questions, I shouldn't give away my tricks, right? But it's a very, very important one, and you can just turn this on yourself, is if someone asks a question that is more philosophical in nature, then to ask in return, why do you ask? Why do you ask that? And then often you'll find out, oh, it's really an expression of some very deep concern they have in their life. You know, someone asks a question is, what did Buddha say about rebirth? Well, I could sit here for the next hour and tell you what Buddha say about rebirth, and I would completely miss that person, why the person's asking the question. You ask the person, you know, why are you asking that? And the person might say, oh, my parents just died. And so they're trying to grapple and come to terms with their parents dying. And that's a whole different conversation then than if you just take, you know, treating it as philosophy or metaphysics. So, do you have any questions? Yes, please.
Could I make a request? Could
yes.
You repeat the question because a lot of us can't hear
it. It's a really good request. And people have, over the years, have tried to hammer this into me. And they used to put a sign on in front of me here that says, repeat the question. And it's really embarrassing, someone who's a mindfulness teacher. But being reminded now, I think I'll remember for the rest of the time. Thank you. And now I'm accountable.
Conversely, people could speak up.
Or people can speak up, too. So please, ask a question. What's your question? Yes.
What is the view or the motivation for meditating?
What's the view and the motivation for meditating? So, someone has Naropa on his sweatshirt. I wonder if I'm being tested. When those, you know, those Tibetans are coming here and they're going to... please ask me why are you asking? It's a good question, and I'd like to ask, find out why.
Well, it's something that I often work with in terms of like working with it for pure motivation and pure view, pure view
of metaphor.
And and I realize how important it is to have that. And so that's where I'm asking. That's where I'm coming from in my question.
Great. So his question is, what is the right view or what's the right motivation for meditation? Or what's the motivation for meditation? And he says he grapples with this a lot in his life, in his practice, you know, his right view, what the view... The view is kind of the understanding or the orientation or the attitude by which we meditate. And the motivation is the motivation, the intention for motivation. And the answer that comes first off my heart, because I feel it's a, you know, for me it's a heartfelt issue, is to feel really happy that you're working with a question. And that working with a question and looking at it is something which never ends. To come to final answer to that question, of this is the view, this is the motivation, I think is to do a disservice. But rather, over time, that changes. And I've seen in myself that's changed over time. And it's been fascinating to track the changes. And so to keep that going as a question, as a concern, and not and kind of always asking that question and coming with new answers and not settling for any answer, I think is really the best way to do it. It reminds me of a famous story of Suzuki Roshi. I think it had to do with Ed Brown asking him a question. And Suzuki Roshi, at some point, as Ed Brown was walking away, spoke out and said, "The most important thing." And Suzuki Roshi had this great timing. So, you know, people are always trying to get the essence of Zen from him. And so finally, you know, "The most important thing." So then he'd pause, and Ed Brown just stopped in his track. He was ready to hear. "The most important thing is to figure out what the most important thing is." Now, I don't think it was meant as a joke. I think it was also meant as, you know, that question, that, as I said in the beginning, to ask questions and keep asking, what is it? What is it? Is the thing. So what's the right view or the right motivation for meditation? And we have some 80 people here in the hall. Would some people like to offer some views and motivations for meditation? What is it for you today, or what has it been this year? What was it when you started?
In my lifetime, I've noticed a tendency toward imbalance, extremes, addictions, all kinds of other issues. And when I first sat in the early 80s, my first long retreat, it wasn't all that great. I mean, I didn't know what to do, what to expect. It's the first time I'd ever been quiet for 24 hours in my life. So it was a big thing that happened. But I noticed a little bit of equanimity after the retreat. Very brief, lost relatively quickly because there wasn't a Sangha particularly at that time in that community. And now, all these years and travels later, I don't really know anymore, if that's my particular motivation. I know it's a side effect of the practice. And I know that I'm kinder to myself and kinder to others as a result over a long period of time. But I don't really expect anything, so I don't know what my motivation is.
So Richard says he doesn't know what his motivation is at some level. And I think probably that echoes with a number of people here. Probably there was a time in my practice where I couldn't discern any motivation, but I sat twice a day anyway. I thought it was kind of odd, but it's what I did. And so Richard said that when he first started sitting, his life was quite imbalanced, going between extremes of various things, addiction and stuff. And he was quite surprised in sitting 24 hours a day in silent retreat, that at the end of the retreat, that there was a certain level of equanimity that he found, and that over the many years of practice, he's found that he's become a kinder person from doing the meditation practice. But he doesn't quite know why he does it. That's not the reason he does it, to become kinder. But he notices that it has this effect on him. Other motivations or understandings of why you meditate? Mark?
Unconsciously, we've been practicing in so many unskillful ways of being. We stress for our body and the cream and grass. And I think because that's become our default, that we need to take time to practice developing some skillful ways of being,
So the distinction between living skillfully and unskillfully, and often for many people living kind of life as it's kind of presented to us, end up having a lot of unskillful habits and unhealthy habits, I suppose. And then a meditation practice is one way to develop healthy or skillful skills, habits that help us in our lives. Is that fair enough? And one of the interesting things about using the word skill and unskillful is that for me, the definition of what's skillful and unskillful depends a little bit about what the purpose is, what you want to accomplish. So would you like to offer something else?
I think it just comes down to living heartfully.
Being kind. So it comes down to being kind, being coming from the heart, being present, being alive. And so that which is skillful is that which moves you in that direction. And that which is unskillful moves you away from that. So one motivation for practice, a series of motivations for practice is to move in that direction with our life, to be kind, present, come from the heart. Yes?
I first started meditating when my life kind of went, things fell apart, as they say. And it was kind of a safe spot to go amidst the chaos. But then, as I began to continue the process, I realized it was a place to go, and I in general, couldn't figure things out. It was a different kind of wisdom. And it had nothing to do with words. And it was like, wow. Nobody told me about this part. And I find that I smile a lot more, you know, and that I don't get upset. And I don't have that a lot more.
So at first, meditation was a place to find some security or safety or refuge in the life falling apart. But then she found that there was a place beyond words that she understanding came. And it seemingly at the same time, there was humor and laughter and smiled more at the things of the world. Yes.
It helps when you have an observing self. Instead of just being swept along by whatever is going on in the moment, whatever my thoughts are, there's like another piece of me that's sitting over here saying, you can make choices about that. It helps me step away from my feelings and the pressure of the moment. And decide rather than react.
So meditation or mindfulness allows him to step back and kind of observe or watch what's going on in a more objective way, so he can see where the choice is about how to act, what to live by, and in that way hopefully live a wiser life. Yes, Mita.
For me, the teachings and the meditation sort of feed on each other. So the more I meditate, the more I want to get the teachings, the more teachings I get, the more I want to meditate. And I'm sitting here and thinking, I don't know how useful meditation would be on its own without the teachings, without the Dharma behind it. And then I suddenly remember when I first came to all this, walked to meditation, there was no Dharma and there was no teaching. I was doing it from tapes, something I'd forgotten. So it was all about just calming yourself, following the breath, and there was no discussion of ethics or anything, just following your breath and the basic meditation instructions. And even that has very profound effect. Somewhere in there, all the chaos and all the anger and frustration and all the negative emotions, somewhere really was a kernel that was really quite wonderful. Even for a very, very short period. Yeah. So having remembered that.
So meditation provided some kind of peace from or in the middle of all these negative emotions. And then as you started meditating, then you found this wonderful reciprocal relationship between meditation and the teachings and ethics and various things. And the more you meditate, the more you wanted to hear the teachings or learn the teachings. And the more you learn the teachings, the more you wanted to meditate. Sounds like it'll never end. Yes?
I have three really juicy situations going on in my life right now. Personal, at work, and all of life. And they all need to be fixed. Lots of little pieces in each one. They need to be fixed. But they're working with compassion. And I'm sitting here tonight, doing this meditation, and I'm just really still and quiet, and it's bubbling, and I'm thinking, you know, maybe I just need to let all those things go and sit. And then all of a sudden, my foot falls asleep, my hip gets a big pain, and my knee went crazy, and I'm sitting here, and I'm feeling just really miserable. And all of a sudden, I just have this big compassion. And it just, this sitting still with all the stuff in mind, and knowing I didn't have to do anything. It was some kind of secret.
Beautiful. So she has three big issues going on in her life, which she has to make a lot of decisions about. And so she came here to sit, and she decided that maybe in sitting here she'd just let go of it and just sit and see what happens. And what happened was she was very uncomfortable sitting. And in the discomfort of it, there arose all this compassion for herself. And with that compassion came the understanding that she doesn't need to do anything. The wisdom of knowing you don't need to do anything. There is wisdom. At the end of the retreat, on Saturday, I think, there were five teachers leading the retreat, and we all got to give our little, you know, advice for leaving the retreat. It's a big deal to leave a retreat after a month or two of silence. And that was my advice, was assume that in many situations you come to over the next days and next week, that nothing needs to happen. If there are pauses in the conversation, nothing needs to happen. If there's pauses in your day, nothing needs to happen. Maybe nothing needs to happen for a while. And there's wisdom in that. Are we moving on? We're ready? But then, no, no. I mean, I assume everybody had a motivation for coming here today to meditate. I mean, it wasn't you were walking down the street and someone didn't just push you in. But I guess people are shy, so... So are you satisfied enough with... You ask a great question. Is this good enough for you?
Sure.
Yeah? We can go on? Go ahead, please. People think they're going to be off...
You can go back to it, yes. This weekend I was at the Sangha Dharma Conference, and there was a lot of eight people and nine people away. And... it was just wonderful, beautiful places where we all reached out. And there were also eight or nine people, and they were fascinating people, and I was having fascinating time talking to all of them. But I came back not rejuvenated, but emotionally just kind of wiped out from all of this interaction. And I've been just puzzling with this all day, trying to kind of figure out how to, I don't know, how to be with that. I have to figure out what that means, or is this an insight, or I'm just not quite sure how to work with that, but that wasn't kind of what I wanted to have it. I'd like to be around fascinating people. Zach, you had some poem you said a while back,
How to be alone with others.
With others, yeah. Now I'm going to be helping you here. Pearls of wisdom. You know, I can kind of work with this. Because I don't want to pull back and say, well, I don't want to have all these fascinating conversations with fascinating people because it wipes me out. That's not the way I want to go.
Oh. Well, you know, sometimes we have to, sometimes we just live life too busily. And we expect to be able to add a little bit of spirituality on top of excessively busy life, and it'll make it all work just beautifully. And it's possible, one possibility is that no sane person should ever talk as much as you did over the hike. It's not a matter of figuring out a better way to talk. It's figuring out how not to talk a little bit, take breaks. So that's one possibility. And but I think your question is good, and to explore that, I think really it's your exploration to explore. How is it when you interact with people? How is it when you talk? Is there desires or expectation? Is there a way in which you listen which is tiring? Is there excessive eagerness in the conversation that is tiring? You know, how is it you engage in conversation? And one way to discover that is also to experiment with different ways. So there are 8-9 people on the hike. So you might experiment with 8 or 9 different ways of having conversations, and then see which one is more rejuvenating, which is more tiring, rather than just using normal habits of how you talk.
Yes. Last week, Pam Weiss spoke on, amongst other things, the word appropriate. And she gave the gloss of the Chinese word as made of 3 ideograms. meet, each, teach, teaching. Are you familiar with that word, and could you comment more on that idea? Because it is exactly that, looking for the question, for position in Zen.
Meet each and teach. I didn't know that about the character. And one of the occupational hazards of a teacher who teaches, has been teaching for many years, is they can talk about anything. So I don't know if that's wise for me to just kind of start talking freely about this topic. But I'll say if you asked. It's been on my mind a little bit today. There's a Zen poem, Chinese Zen poem, that has a line in it that says, it, and here it probably means reality, it responds to the inquiring impulse. So this is inquiring, this questioning of reality, this inquiring and being mindful and being engaged, and what's this, what's this? That there's somehow something is returned to you in that process. It's not just something that, you know, simply you're doing in your own personal mind, but somehow reality, the world, other people respond somehow to the inquiring impulse. So meet each and teach. If you meet something, then really meet something, meet a situation, meet another person, then there's an opportunity. And appropriate? I don't know how to weave in appropriate into that, all that. But
she spoke of how to, I think she was talking about beneficence, how to do good.
Uh-huh.
And then one does good things by doing that which is appropriate to the moment. There is no absolute platonic ideal of the good.
Right. Did she give the quote of the famous story of the monk asked the Zen master who'd been a Zen practitioner for a lifetime, and the monk asked, she gave that story, what's your essential teaching or what have you learned? And he responded, an appropriate response. I mean, that's
that is the story she spoke of.
Yeah. So, what? What's a teaching of a lifetime? Appropriate response. It's a beautiful story. And again, it lends itself to not having some kind of fixed dogma that you fall back on, but rather it's really what's alive right now. It's in the living situation right now where you find the truth, you find how to live, you find how to respond. What's the request of this situation? And that's always going to be unique to the living situation you find yourself in. And to go carry along some old teaching you have, may or may not work. You have to find where the life is in this situation. So they have then also in the Zen tradition, the idea that a person's practice is never finished. Whereas in the Theravada tradition, they have an idea that a person's spiritual practice comes to an end when there's no more greed, hate, or delusion in the person's psyche. But in the Zen tradition, they don't posit an end to practice. You might come to a situation where greed, hate, and delusion is eliminated in the psyche, but the person still has to live. And every situation you encounter is a new, unique situation. And so you have to bring your mindfulness and your understanding, your compassion to bear to understand how to meet this situation. And that's so practice never ends, because you always come into a new situation. So every situation is an opportunity for an appropriate response. Meet each and teach. I think that's great.
Yeah. I've been kind of wondering, only in little bits, but for quite a long time. I guess I often feel like, particularly in my meditation, that just my whole mind and body feels too dense. There's no room for a question. And that sometimes I do manage to ask, how is it that I can cultivate a questioning mind?
Uh-huh.
And so far, I haven't figured out anything to move that along. It's just, it's something that's very important to have this question in mind.
Yeah.
The practice often feels kind of flat.
Mm-hmm. So he says that the practice often feels kind of flat. When he sits, his mind and body feel kind of dense. And in that kind of dense situation, he can't quite muster up or find the questioning mind. But the questioning mind seems to be very important for him. And the kind of the paradox here is that in asking that question, he's mustered up his questioning mind. So one of the things you can do if you feel something getting in the way of some ideal that you have, like wanting to have a mind that questions more fully or more, and what you do is you bring your mindfulness to bear on the obstacle and explore that, question that. What is this? And the question doesn't have to be more complex than the question, what is this? And so then you go and investigate the denseness and see what's going on there. See if you can penetrate the denseness of the mind, the denseness of the body. And you might be surprised what you find if you penetrate it.
I was just wondering about your own practice. Because I know you have a family now, so you're probably about 50 years. So I imagine I don't know if you still meditate 2 times a day or not. And if you don't,
so Helen's asking me if about my own practice, and now that I have a family with 2 kids, she can't imagine that maybe I still meditate twice a day, and so how do I sustain, you know, the benefits that come from meditation? And no, I don't sit twice a day. Usually, sometimes I do. What I try to do is sit once a day. And I used to sit very kind of regularly, first thing in the morning when I got up, and I still try to do that. This morning I got 20 minutes in before my son ran in and plopped himself down on my lap, and sometimes I get longer, sometimes I get shorter, sometimes I don't get any. But then if I don't sit in the morning or sit very long, then I'll try to do it later in the day, when you know there is some space in the day, and get it that way. And but if I sit once a day, I'm content with that. And in terms of this, you know, you use the word stillness, the quality of my mind in terms of being still or being active. I know I'd have a higher quality of a mind or higher stillness if I sat more. If I sat all day, it'd be great. I'm not actually trying to pursue having as still a mind as possible. There's a wonderful balance between a balance that's constantly changing, where the balance is for me between sitting and meditating and getting the benefits from meditation and then engaging in the world that I live and learning from that. And like Smita said, there's a reciprocal relationship between teaching and meditation. There's a reciprocal relationship between what I learn and what I learn about myself and life as I try to engage in practice in my daily life. And then I bring that to my meditation. And then what happens there, I bring that to my daily life. And so I feel like it's kind of a dynamic system together. And so that's how it is for me. I hope that was all right with you, not to have a regular talk. I appreciate it a lot, the questions and the comments. It felt rich to me.